Hi, I'm James P. Friel.
And I'm Dean Holland. It's time to fasten your seatbelts, boys and girls.
That's right. If you're an entrepreneur who's wanting to take your business to the next level and have a bit of fun while getting cutting-edge advice on your business, marketing, and sales, welcome to Just the Tips, arguably the best podcast in the entire world. That's good, right?
Yeah, sounds good to me.
All right. That was easy. Yeah. That was the easiest thing we did all day.
Yeah.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Just the Tips. This is your host, James P. Friel. I am thrilled that you guys are here with us today. We have a show that selfishly I have been very excited about for, you know, I'm like a five-year-old when it comes to anticipating things I'm excited about. So it's probably been really a couple months, but it's felt like 5 to 10 years at least. And what's more amazing is that Dean is actually on time today for the show. He just got into the studio, rode in on his white noble steed. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show, the one, the only bearded wonder from the United Kingdom, Mr. Dean Holland.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Oh, what's happening? How you doing, James? Good to be
excellent.
Here.
Excellent. How are you today, man?
Oh, I am very good. Every week is a good week when I get to spend it with you. I told you this.
Yes, but I've never believed you because generally the statement that follows is like, I can't stand you, or why does my life suck so much that I have to spend time with you? But
You're reading my thoughts now.
Yes, just for keeping the peace and pleasantries. Thank you. I appreciate that. I'll tell you what. So I just mentioned a minute ago how excited I am for our guest today and for the show. Because we've got somebody who has a wealth of experience. You know, we have a lot of entrepreneurs on the show. Adam, who is our guest, I'm bring him on in just a second. Not only is he a serial entrepreneur, but an academic researcher on business models and how to actually structure and architect business models that that work, that are sustainable, that give you a competitive advantage. And, you know, not only has he, you know, started multiple companies, he's sold companies for multiple eight figures in the venture capital space, super experienced guy. And somehow or another, he agreed to come on the show with us and we're thrilled to have him here. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show, Mr. Adam Bach. How are you today, Adam?
I am great. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry about Dean. He's just like, you know, he's here.
Now?
You're going to have to deal with him. I apologize.
You have to let me at least do something wrong.
Well, it's a preemptive apology, really. You know, because I know there's no question you're going to do something. So, So Adam, we really are very excited to have you here today. And as I, you know, we were kind of getting to know each other a little bit before we went on the air. You know, one of the things that I mentioned was we have so many entrepreneurs who listen to this show who are putting in the hard work, right? Mm-hmm. They're working, you know, 8, 10, 12 hours a day, you know, doing what it takes to grow their business. And sometimes they're just not really making the traction over the long term with all of their efforts. And one of the things that I've become fascinated with is, well, what business model are you putting that effort into? And you've done an extraordinary amount of research on business models. You've written a book on business models, which is, awesome book. And so I just really want to dig into this subject today. Before we kind of unpack that and get to the tips, can I ask you why you even became so interested in business models to begin with?
Yeah. So, and actually that's great because the very first thing I wanted to do before we go any further is I do have to do a quick shout out to Professor Jerry George. Jerry is the dean of the business school at Singapore Management University. He was my PhD supervisor. He is phenomenal academic, business expert, and friend. And your question is perfect for that because he's the reason that I started studying business models.
That's amazing. And before you go, I guess I need to recant It's Dr. Adam Bach. I didn't even realize that.
Dr. Bach is my father, actually. My dad's a retired surgeon. I've never really gotten used to that because he was always Dr. Bach, and so when I did the PhD, it felt very strange. It's that sort of very cliche kind right. of thing. So it is technically, and I do use that in my classrooms with my undergraduates just to kind of remind them. But beyond right. that, I don't really use that at all.
Listen, kids, I'm a doctor. You better pay attention to
right, right. right. Dan Millman, it's, it yeah, sounds right. so good, you know?
So, okay. So it was inspired by a mentor.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Jerry. So I had been an entrepreneur coming out of a business environment after an MBA and some engineering experience and starting these, mostly biotech companies, really. And had made the decision that I wanted to go back and do some academic work because, in fact, I'd already written a book with Jerry about academic entrepreneurs because all of my startups were spun out of universities. And so I contacted Jerry and I was kind of a little late to the game. You know, at that point, I was already 30 years old. Normally, the PhDs start when you're like 21 or 22. And I called Jerry and I said, hey, Jerry, I really think I actually kind of want to do this PhD after all. Is it too late? And he says, no, it's not too late, but it is kind of getting late. All right. Well, and I said, can I come do the PhD with you in London? Because at the time, Jerry was at Imperial College. And he agreed, and we were able to work things out. And when I got there, we started talking, and I said, "What do you,
James, there you go.
Is that you singing?
There you go. There you go.
No, that was not me singing.
The audio guy, he had something on. I don't know what's going on. He's nuts. He's fired, by the way. He's gone.
All right. Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Adam, we're a very, very professional production here, as you can see. Carry on with the story then.
Yeah. So Jerry said, I think we should study business models. And I said, oh, it seems like a great idea. Everybody's talking about it. I've been talking about it. The managers and executives I talk with talk about it. And he said, great, what is it? And I said, I have no idea.
Well, that's a $1 million question. And so it is a commonly held buzzword. Everyone's like, oh man, these guys have a great business model. Oh, that's not a good, like, what are people really talking about when they say business model? Like, what does that even mean?
Yeah. And that was, I think I benefited from that discrepancy more than anybody else on earth, because I wrote my entire PhD about the fact that people didn't know what the heck they were talking about, right? Literally, my thesis was, when managers talk about business models, they're not talking about the same thing that academic professors and researchers are talking about business models. So the vast majority of all this research that's already been done is basically useless, because it's not what managers mean. It was fun because we were right at this time where, we'd gotten out of a decade past the dot-com, boom and bust, when business models really kind of emerged as something, right? Back at a time when people are like, oh, your business model doesn't have to make money anymore, right? It's okay. You can still have a wildly successful company, even though you don't have a business model that makes money. So we sorted that out. That took a couple of years to sort out. But then now we're at this time where everybody's talking about business models again, and nobody can agree on what they are. And you're exactly right. We would go to people and we'd say, can you talk about your company's business model? And they'd explain what their business model was. And it was pretty compelling. And then we'd say, hey, that's really great. So what is a business model? And then there'd be this long, uncomfortable silence, right? While they tried to sort out in their head. They knew what their business model was, but nobody knew what a business model was. So that was what we did. We spent a couple of years kind of talking with an awful lot of people, looking at what other people had written, and we began putting all of this together. And the funny part, of course, is that this, the book, the business model book that you mentioned, was technically our second book on business models, which I think has been a little more, it's gotten a little more traction. It's been translated into about 5 different languages now, and we've seen, at least some enthusiasm. But our first book on business models, you've never heard of, and we've sort of buried, because it was more for an academic audience. It was really, it was called Models of Opportunity. We published it through Cambridge, so you can tell right off the bat we were not shooting for high sales. And but nobody read it. Like no one on earth read that book. And it was obtuse, and it didn't. I'm not sure we made a lot of sense in it. I think we tried to say something useful, but it just didn't. It didn't play, because it's a tough topic, really. Because this idea did come from practice, from managers talking about it. And then when researchers got into it, they tried to put parameters around it that were testable and researchable, and that moved it away from what managers were really talking about.
Well, that's, so, I mean,
that's been a problem.
That's really interesting, because I think, you know, it's a topic that, you know, maybe some people understand, but I think the idea that researchers would want to put parameters around it makes sense, because then you can influence things. You know what levers to pull, you know how to, you know, create better designs. And up until that point, it's almost like, oh, that guy sort of has an intuitive knowledge of how to create a business model that works. This guy doesn't even know what that means, but he's still pulling it off. And these guys seem to think they know what business models mean, but their business sucks. Right. And so yes. It's like all these different things at play. So maybe just in a really concise way, like, could you define what you guys have unpacked, like, as the definition of, like, what is a business model?
Right. So we, after looking at a lot of sort of perspectives from managers and executives and researchers, we felt like we could define it in a relatively concise way as being associated with a couple of very specific things. And this definition that we came up, that we reached, and has, you know, it's not the definitive definition still in the, you know, for researchers, there's still 20 years later, there's still argument about all this, but we tried to focus it in on a couple of very specific things. Number one, it has to be about the way the organization is designed, right? It's the way the pieces fit together in however the organization actually functions. It has to address an opportunity, right? There has to be some mechanism or connection between what the organization is capable of and what's out in the environment, such that there's actually an opportunity that can be exploited. And then there has to be some mechanism that there's value being created and captured, right? Mm. So those were the in the final analysis, those were the things we brought together. And I don't even remember the exact wording of it, the design of an organization to, you know, to exploit an opportunity that, you know, creates and captures value. That was kind of where we got to with this. And there were, you know, there were lots of sort of sub pieces that built up into it, but that was kind of the basis for, you know, where we ended up with going to the book and trying to then unpack that into all the steps and stages that you could use in order to try to see if you actually had something like that, that could work.
That's interesting. So, like, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs, and I would say all the good ones, are very return driven, right? They're like, all right, What's the point of this?
Right.
You know? And so I would throw that out here and say, okay, like, you know, because I think sometimes in academia, it's like, all right, there's like really something interesting to study for the sake of understanding and knowing. But then as it gets deployed into, you know, quote, the real world, people are like really putting things through their paces and, you know, using that information to generate a return. In your mind, what would you say is like the importance of understanding this? Like, why would somebody take, you know, time? Well, first of all, I don't know why anybody's taking time to listen to Dean and I in the first place. But, you know, now that we've got somebody credible here like yourself.
Yeah, I worry I'm not helping you here, but I'll do my best. I don't want to make it worse.
Well, we do have two loyal listeners, Dean's mom and my dog Louie back here.
Well, we do also have the nation of Sheng Zhao.
That's right. The province of Zhengzhou turns out to be a hotspot for our listeners.
Interesting. Oh, well, yes. The book's in Chinese, so maybe we're in good shape.
Well, there we go. Now you're going to see your Zhengzhou sales really skyrocket. So what is the, like, what is the importance, and why would we want to study this and really think through these questions about our own business models in our companies?
Yeah.
Good question, James.
It is actually, it is a really, really good question. And it's a question that, in fact, I think doesn't get asked often enough, right? Because I think people just kind of start with whatever they've seen about business models, usually the canvas now, right? Because that's become the dominant framework that everybody uses. And that's good. I mean, I'm a big fan of Alexander Osterwalder, and the canvas is brilliant, and I teach it in my classes. But it's not enough. And understanding that this is about how you design an organization, right? I mean, because this is sort of the funny thing about this is when I work with entrepreneurs and, you know, having been an entrepreneur, entrepreneurs sometimes forget that the organization's just a tool. That's all it is, right? It's just a tool in your tool belt. If you could make the value without the organization, why wouldn't you?
Right.
Right. Like if it was a pure arbitrage and you could do it from your desk and you didn't have to hire anyone, you didn't have to talk to anybody, wouldn't you just do it that way? The organization's just a mechanism that has certain big advantages to it, right? Like scalability and replicability and, and then of course things like limited liability, which is usually also a good idea. We want to recognize that all of these are simply pieces that lead to something that's then very effective, right? And so this aspect of making sure there's an opportunity, making sure that there's a way of creating the value, because if you're not creating value, then either you're destroying value or you're stealing value. And I don't think either of those are sustainable for the long haul. And then you still have to have a way to capture it, right? It's not enough just to say, wow, what we're doing is really valuable for people, because if it is, but people won't pay for it, you're still kind of out of luck, right? Mm-hmm. Or if you're going to create all this value and then it's going to be exploited by another organization. I do some consulting work. I'll just give you a quick example. I'm doing some consulting. I always continue to do a lot of work with universities, and I'm doing work with the University of Minnesota right now for their tech transfer office on spinning biotech companies out. We just had a conversation this last week with this unbelievably cool biotechnological innovation that, for all I know, could cure major diseases into the future. And the problem is that it requires a complementary asset. It requires a technology that's already commercialized and owned in the marketplace. And we know that when you try to bring an innovation to market and you have to use a complementary asset that someone else owns, then the research shows that that's the company that's going to capture all the value out of it. Like, you'll be lucky to get your little piece, because
the guys that already have the thing deployed in the world.
Yes, because they're right. Otherwise, because they have all the power in the negotiation. They can just walk away. They'd be like, yeah, we love your idea, but if you're not willing to play ball, we're just going to say no, because we still have our business, right? And right. This is this running challenge where it's not just about the technology. It's never just about the technology. It's never just about the idea, right? It's all about the implementation, and it's all about how it fits into the broader environment that you have to compete. And that's it's a really frustrating thing for entrepreneurs and scientists to face, because they're under the impression, dude, I've done the hard work. I came up with the cool idea, right? Mm-hmm. So where's my money? And like those
money
of us,
that simple.
Right? I mean, I that was the way I thought about it the first time through as well. And then you discover that it doesn't work like that. Like, you have an idea and you still have to create 99% of the value of the ultimate organization and the venture, with actually getting it accepted and out into the market and implemented. And that's where all of this comes together, is kind of recognizing that the hard work is still to come, even after you've had the brilliant idea.
Right, right. Because you have to build the business around the idea.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? It's not just the idea, and the business needs to take shape in order to get that idea, creating value and then capturing value and, creating competitive advantage and like all of those things. And so so just to like sort of unpack some of these elements of the structure of thinking through the business model. You mentioned a few of them. What would be, obviously we don't have, days to analyze a particular company or anything here, but just, we are called Just the Tips.
This is true.
Right? It is until we may make a name change called Just the Doug, but that was just, that has to go before the committee to vote on that. So now that he fired the guy who was interrupting us, like, it's still a possibility. But so if we're looking at how to evaluate, now we have an idea, whether it's a new idea or an existing idea, right? Because it doesn't even necessarily matter if it's been an idea we've been trying to run with for a year or two or three or whatever. It's like there's different questions and different angles to be looking at this through, different lenses perhaps. Walk us through the first thing that an entrepreneur should be thinking when they're really trying to evaluate their business model.
Sure. Yeah. And I think the first thing is always, problem solution fit. Right. So is there an actual problem out in the market? is there and does whatever and whatever your idea is, whatever the product is, whatever the service is, does it actually meet an underlying need that you can identify and that customers are likely to potentially pay for? And the nice thing is that, you know, you can do that in one of the canvases. You can use, for example, Ash Moria's Lean Canvas, which I actually think for startups and early stage is better than the business model canvas because it does have that problem solution piece right there, you know, before you know what the activities are, before you know what the resources of the organization are, before you know what your key partnerships are. That problem solution fit's absolutely essential. But I will tell you that the reason this fails for so many entrepreneurs in my experience, and it's failed once for me as well, and, you know, for entrepreneurs I've tried to mentor and companies I've seen and so on, it's because the impression is that the problem is whatever our technology solves.
Right.
That's we have this hammer. Dude, there's got to be some nails around here somewhere, you know, somewhere, something we can hit with this thing, right? And you know, that it's and that's the joke I make in a lot of my classrooms is, you know, when you're trying to put a, you know, when you're trying to hang a painting or something on the wall, you know, you don't actually need a lump of metal. I mean, this misshapen lump of metal, that's just a, it just happens to be a convenient thing that most people have. So they use that, right? If you had a magic wand that could instantaneously put nails in the wall without any effort and it didn't cost much to use, that would be preferable, right? Because then you can hand it off to someone else or put it in the drawer. And, you know, it's just so this is this fundamental, this critical first step, because it's not what you think the problem is. It's what your customers think the problem is, right? Yeah. And very often, those are two totally different things. Like, you've noticed that customers complain about the price of a given product in the market. And so you've built something that's a little bit cheaper. And then you go out there figuring, you know, the world's going to beat a path to your door. And then nobody buys the damn thing. And it's because you didn't actually figure out what on earth their pain point was. You don't know what they're, you don't know what problem they're trying to solve. And the worst part is you usually can't even ask them, because of all the problems with, you know, things like social desirability bias, where people just tell you what they think you want to hear, right? You got to observe them. You got to go out there and you got to see what they're doing and you got to find out what their day-to-day pains and problems are. And then that's how you build a potential solution. And if it uses your technology, fantastic, right? That's, that means you're in a great spot. But, you know, a lot of times entrepreneurs go out and they look at the, they finally look at the customer and talk to the customer and observe the customer. And then they kind of step back and go, you know, damn, technology doesn't deal with any of that stuff, right? And then sometimes they move forward anyway under the theory that they can educate their customers. And that's always kind of a, you know, it's possible, but it's a whole different proposition because people don't like to change. Anytime you're trying to change your customers, that's a bad starting point, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I see that a lot. You know, everybody, especially entrepreneurs, like, they're like, you know, machine guns for ideas.
Right.
It's like, I've got another one. Well, you just had like 10 seconds ago and it's just like, it's just like bullets spraying across the room. Just all these different ideas.
Well, I can definitely say I've made that mistake in the past. I think the honest truth of analyzing it is I was probably a bit more egotistical driven many years ago, where I thought that I've had this idea. It's a great idea. Right. And you just deploy all your energy and efforts into creating this vision of this thing because your idea is so wonderful. And then, like you say, then you turn to the marketplace and you're like, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah. This isn't quite going the way I thought it would. It was great, grand in my mind.
Yeah, sort of like how I thought this was going to be a fun podcast to do with Dean. And then he shows up wearing a Hawaiian floral t-shirt.
Hey, look, I haven't left the UK since October last year. If I want to feel a bit tropical today, I can do that. You should be thankful I don't stand up. I'm completely naked from the shirt down.
Right. Yeah, I'm very, very grateful.
Please don't stand up. Thank you.
All right, let me turn your camera off. You know, it's so obvious when you say something like that, Adam. You know, like, oh, make sure there's actually a problem for your solution. But it really is worth repeating, even as I think through the different ideas and ventures that I've started, or even just, you know, products within ventures or whatever. It's a really solid reminder.
Well, the challenge is people don't say it that way, right? So like when you have entrepreneurs who are struggling, they don't say, I don't understand why my product doesn't fit the market need. What they say is, I don't understand why my customers don't see the value in this. right? Like, I don't, you know, yeah. It's so obvious. Why are my customers so stupid? Right. Yeah. Like, you know, I think I see the source of the problem. This isn't going to get better. Right. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. And I do think there are a lot of people who are like, oh, this thing is so good. We'll just educate the world on how good it is. And if that even works, that's a 10 or 20 or 30 year effort,
right,
to educate a significant amount of people. Yeah. Okay. So tip one, problem solution fit, which is simple and brilliant all at the same time. So, okay. So let's say we have done some research. We have talked to our customers or prospects or the market. We feel like we have a good solution to the problem that they have. Mm-hmm. Now what?
So I think at this point, you do have the option of beginning to put together, you know, one of the business model canvases, right? And in the book, we talked about there being, you know, different levels of complexity you can go to, whether you're, you know, if you're really ready for the full, you know, Osterwalder's business model canvas. I tend to recommend against that right at the beginning. I think the lean canvas is usually a good place to start. You know, we created that little RTVN, even pre-idea canvas, just to identify what your key resources are, the transactions of the organization, the value you create, and sort of the narrative that holds it all together. But I you can use almost any one of those to begin laying out the ideas.
Can you elaborate on RTVN? What does that stand
sure.
for?
Sure. Yeah. So RTVN is resources, transactions, values, and narrative. And this came out of our research, you know, and I always hesitate to dig too far into sort of the academic side of this, but so this came out of, you know, when Jerry and I were looking at this and thinking, you know, it doesn't seem like anybody knows what the heck this business model thing is. Jerry is just a brilliant entrepreneurial academic, because he recognized that meant that there was theoretically a market for academic research on business models, right? Mm-hmm. And so he's a tremendous entrepreneur, sort of entrepreneurial thinker in his own right.
That's like real meta inception stuff, right?
It
there.
Really is, yeah, right. Yeah. And I didn't get it at the time. It took me a good 7 or 8 years to figure all of that out. He was very patient. but so the idea being that what we did then was we looked at all of what had been published. I mean, we read like 1,000 papers that had already been published about business models at that point, to see what, you know, what academics and practitioners were at least claiming business models were about. And that was covering everything from like digital business models in, you know, specifically in IT, to construction business models and then really sophisticated academic research on how business models theoretically created value. So the two researchers who really sort of pioneered all this, Amit and Zot, really kind of led the way on business models. I can talk about how their thinking changed, and in some ways they kind of got, I mean, they're fantastically successful academics, but they got a little bit shortchanged on the business model definition, because theirs was spectacular, but it was just hard to work with. So we did all this research about, you know, on what was being said about business models. And we went out and talked to, you know, hundreds of managers to find out, you know, what do you think a business model is? Can you define it? We gave them examples. We let them try to pick through definitions. You know, we handed them academic definitions and asked them if they could figure out what they meant. It was actually flashcards. We actually handed, I had like the seven definitions that we'd found sort of most commonly cited in the literature. And I just handed them to managers and said, do you understand what any of these mean? And they were just look at me funny. So that was my introduction to academic research, really being looked at funny a lot. So what we did then is we did basically a meta-analysis where we said, here's what everyone is saying. How can we generate patterns out of all of the things that they're saying? And out of that came these four areas: the resources of the organization, the transactions that the organization, the venture participates in, the value it creates and the way it creates that value, and then the narrative that sort of they tell each other internally or externally that sort of holds all of that together. And so out of that, we just said, you know, these other canvases are awesome, but if you're if you're basically at almost the pre-idea stage, like you just have this glimmer of an idea, you think there's a problem out there and you might have a solution for it, you've come up with a way of changing how a current business runs, then maybe just a really simple piece of paper in which you list out what you think the key resources would be. That is, what are the assets, capabilities of the organization that are useful, right? So Google has the PageRank algorithm, right? And Walmart has its incredibly efficient distribution network, right? And Southwest has really well-trained employees who are cross-functional and they only buy one kind of plane so that everybody can work, you know, on any flight. And you have companies that have specific intellectual property that no one else has, right? So those resources and capabilities that come together, the transactions, who does it interact with? Who would be involved in actually producing the whatever it is that you end up selling? Mm-hmm. How does that transaction actually take place? And then how is that value created? What is the customer actually getting? Are they getting a thing? Are they getting convenience, right? So much of the consumer world is built not around the thing you get, but how easy it is to get or how easy that thing makes the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. And then what is the narrative that pulls all this together? Like, why is it your company that could do this? Why hasn't it been done already? What is the story that suggests that if you could link those resources into transactions and create value, that there'd then be a successful entity that could compete in the marketplace? And that can be a pretty fast process. I mean, that is like a 20, 30 minute sort of activity you can go through just to identify those different elements. And that's really, you know, a highly simplified way of plotting out where your business model is going to have to be eventually.
Well, I'm so glad you also said it can be fast, because I think a lot of entrepreneurs take this ready, fire, aim approach. And not only do they take that approach, I think they're largely applauded for taking that approach. And, you know, and it's like 1 in 1,000 or less that has a, you know, massively successful business who took that approach. Meanwhile, the other 999, you don't ever hear about that they failed because they did take that approach, right? Yeah. But we know the statistics of, you know, starting and running a company are not very favorable. Mm. And it seems like if there were some strategic thinking and a little bit of a pause after that moment of inspiration or brilliance, you know, the lightning strikes,
yeah,
go through something like this, we could probably say no to things that wouldn't work a lot faster instead of investing, you know, tens or hundreds or millions of dollars and massive amounts of time before we're just like, oh, I wish I had thought about this.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. No, fail fast. You've got to think that way, right? You've got to have all of the processes in place to make sure that, you know, you're looking actively for all the reasons that it isn't going to work. And the comment you made was 100% right. I actually say that in my programs with executives who are trying to be intrapreneurial. I say it with my students in the classroom. I'm like, wouldn't it be nice to know this isn't going to work now before you've spent $250,000 of your friends and family's money? And then you have to go back to them and say, hey, you know, I could have figured this out last year, but you know, hey, sorry.
Sorry, and I was excited.
That is exactly right. I got excited about it. I wasn't really, I didn't think it through, and I'm really sorry. But I have this new idea, which is totally going to work this time.
Yeah. How many times are you going to be able to dip that bucket in the well? I don't know.
Yeah. So, but it is worth pointing out that, I mean, the lean framework, you know, not so much the fire aim, but, you know, the build, the prototyping, I think is it beautifully complements business model thinking, right? You just have to do it in the right way. And it's kind of this, you know, the comment I made was you put all these ideas down, maybe it's the RTVN network, maybe you do a lean canvas. That could be a viable business model eventually. putting it on paper doesn't make it a viable business model. Like, I have a lot of students and a lot of entrepreneurs who draft up a business model because that's what the books tell them to do. Yeah. And they're like, look, I have a viable business model because I got it all down on paper. I'm like, that's a piece of paper. Congratulations, with writing on it. I love it. It's like a map. It's fantastic.
Yeah, but it looks really good.
It totally does. Sometimes they have drawings. Some of the more artistic ones use colors. I love it, right? It's great. But
smart
it's,
use of font change.
Yeah, throw a little finger paint on there and you're like ready to rock and roll.
And it's part of that same excitement, right? You kind of, because you feel like you've made it more concrete, right? You really feel like you have. The thing I do with a lot of my entrepreneurs, I am so going to get myself in trouble here, is so years and years ago, before he decided to run for president and before all sorts of other things had happened, Kanye West put together a business model, sort of. I don't know if you ever saw this. If you haven't seen this, this is such a digression that's going to, but it's totally worth it. Stephen Colbert did a fantastic sequence about it. Years and years ago. This was right after the whole Taylor Swift Grammy mess.
Right.
And Kanye had this, he basically, the name of the venture was Donda. And it was, and he put a little canvas together. It wasn't actually a business model canvas, but it was for all practical purposes the exact same thing, right? It was, here's a list of ideas that I'm going to put together, and this is going to be a viable business. And then the upshot was that he went to Twitter and started asking people for money, right? He's like, hey, Mark Zuckerberg, I could really use $1 billion to make this work. like that is a damn good pitch. Like if that worked, you've only got to work once.
Yeah, right? That's right. Right. Yeah.
But the problem is that this is this process that Kanye did is what a lot of entrepreneurs do as well, which is they put the stuff down on paper and it's so vague, right? So like, Kanye's Donda business model it had some really cool stuff on it, like, I don't remember, 7-screen movie experience, but it also had stuff on it that was a little less compelling, like cars.
Right.
And you're like, yeah, okay. I mean, sure, but what? And this is what we run into with a lot of entrepreneurs when they start business model canvassing, is the stuff they put down on the canvas is really painfully vague. Like it's not just vague, it's untestable. And that's really where these things fall down, because the way you complement business model thinking is with lean thinking about getting something fast and cheap and simple that still allows potential customers to say, oh, I could use that, or mm-hmm. I don't get it. Like, mm-hmm. why are you showing me this? Right. I don't need that. And that's that bridge, right? We try to talk about this in the book a lot, like that bridge between the piece of paper, which you're all, you've sort of poured your heart into, but is really honestly worthless. And an actual viable business model is whether or not you've tested, whether you've done any kind of testing at all with partners, customers, industry experts, right? Getting something in front of them, even if you just put the canvas in front of them mm-hmm. and say, here's what I want to do. Like, would people pay for that? Or would you pay for that? And that's where those things come together, right? And that's where you do want to use that, not fire aim, but build and then measure, right? That's mm-hmm. that key difference. And when I see entrepreneurs do that, when I see them quickly get something in front of potential customers, that's when they get the really useful information. The sad part is half the time they still don't listen to it. I mean, I can't tell you how many times entrepreneurs right. do that, and then they get the feedback from their customers, which is, I don't really want this. And then sometimes they're because they're just so bought into, they're so emotionally attached.
We must have asked the wrong people.
I asked the wrong question. Adam didn't really know what he was talking about. Like, there's all sorts of great excuses for when that happens. And having been there myself, like my first venture that failed, it's hard, right? You know it in your deep in your soul. You know this idea is gonna work. It's just no one else gets it.
Right.
Yeah.
Fools.
Right.
It's amazing. Well, I was, and that I think that sort of leads to the question I was going to ask is, like, how do you know when you have a good business model? And is it through that iterative process of, you know, that's really interesting that you said you even just share the canvas or the framework with people and kind of like, I guess a discussion at least is better than not having a discussion about
it. Oh yeah.
Right? I actually really like that thought process. Like, I have this idea, like, would you pay for it? You know, like, is this something you would buy? Like, would that be of value to you? I like that approach.
Yeah, it's interesting. How do you think that you mentioned, you know, kind of basically you said like social bias or something earlier, but, or as I would put it in layman's terms, people pleasing and unwillingness to have conflict.
Yes.
A lot of people might say, oh yeah, that sounds really cool. And then, you know, you sort of build something and, oh yeah, yeah, I'm not going to pay for it.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. It's a challenge, right? And half the problem is who we ask, right? So, you know, I point out to students, it's not going to work to go to your parents and tell them about your idea, right? That's not going to, that just does not help. Because, you know, they're biased. They, I presume, like you. So, if they don't, that's a topic for a different classroom. Like, right. we don't deal with that particular problem in the business school. You're on your own. it is an issue, right? Because we tend to go to like-minded people, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we do. We go to people and sometimes that can work really well, because if they're people we trust and we have really strong relationships with, and they're reasonably more business oriented, you know, and have some experience, they can usually be honest with us. Mm. But sometimes it just completely fails. You go to people that you like and who like you and don't want to see you disappointed. So you do need to think about that carefully. This socialization of ideas, in my opinion, is a critical first step for getting to something beyond the piece of paper, right? So you definitely run that risk of showing people the canvas and having them say, oh yeah, that sounds like it could work. Going to potential customers, even with a canvas, you'd be surprised. Customers are, I think, they'll suffer from that same bias, that social desirability bias, but they're also in a circumstance where they may not want to waste more time on it. And if they're like, I don't see how I would use that. But nothing beats creating something that they can touch and feel, or, you know, imagine being bolted on to their supply chain and trying to figure out what they could do with it. And prototyping doesn't have to be a 3D printed doohickey, right? A prototype can be a service walkthrough, right? Or let's do basically a Gestalt experiment in which, you know, you're about to go and buy this thing that you need for your process. Walk me through how you actually go and do that. Like, what are the key decision points? Like, a customer journey map in that situation can be just insanely powerful for helping you realize how customers actually make decisions about what they buy and where does your idea fit into that. But ultimately, the closer you can get to whatever it is they think that they currently, whatever it is that you think is actually going to be, whether it's an, you know, whether it is a service, whether it is a device, whether it's a component, the better the feedback you'll get, right? This is the whole build, measure, learn challenge, is how high fidelity can your prototype actually be? So that's, you know, that's where that opportunity is, but it is a running challenge. But you've got to socialize. And if you don't socialize, then I think that you're just waiting for the right person to smack you down. One of the stories I like to tell is back when I was doing angel investing work, you know, we were getting, you know, hundreds of business plans every month. And I got one that was so vague. I mean, it was a really cool idea because it was, at the time, it was around cybersecurity, you know, and back in 2001, that was, you know, cybersecurity, that was a new topic, right? And so here was someone who was actually thinking about this and had a little bit of online, you know, experience at a very early stage. But the business plan was really, really vague, and it was really hard to understand what he was talking about. I mean, I could see that there was something there, but I couldn't figure out quite what it was. And I called him and I said, you know, I got this. And, you know, just the fact that I'm calling means that there's some interest, because we reject 80% of these without a call. But your plan's really vague, so can you tell me more about it? And he said, no.
Oh.
Like, no, that's all of the thinking that I have in this, or like, that's an awesome response.
And I said, why not? And he said, well, he said, you know, two reasons. One, I'm concerned you might not understand it. And two, if you do understand it, I'm concerned you might steal it. And my response was, well, then it's clearly not robust enough for us to invest in. Thanks. You know, you've got to be willing to talk about your ideas. You've got to be willing to get out there and explain them, find people you trust, put the idea in front of them as early as possible. Like if you're not willing to share your idea and talk about it with people, then as, you know, as an investor, I'm totally not interested. Like right. I can't, that means that this thing is not sustainable. It's not protectable. It's not robust. It's, you know, so you got to do that. And you should be happy if you do that and people tell you fairly quickly and prove to you that it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Like, how cool is that to find out your business model sucks fast? So you can stop wasting time on it and start working on something that actually has some potential. But it's tough as an entrepreneur. That's really, you know, it's mm-hmm. hard. The first couple times you go through this process, your ego gets bruised and you take it, right. you know, you take it personally. It was my idea. You're not criticizing my idea. You're criticizing me.
Mm. Right.
That's yeah. hard. Right. And I work with my entrepreneurs to try to prepare them for that. It isn't you. It's just the idea. You're not the idea. You'll have, this is just your first gig, right? It's just your first gig. You're going to have lots of gigs, you know, and hopefully one of them will hit and you'll buy that island in the Bahamas and you'll buy me that motorcycle I want and, you know, and yeah. we'll all be happy. But it's just your first gig and if you can't separate the idea from your ego, you're already in trouble.
Yeah, that's. I think that's a really good point. That's a really good reframe too. It's a if your thing gets squashed early on, like that's a victory because you don't have to invest time and resource in, you know, building it out and all that other stuff, and it shows you the flaws there. So maybe you can strengthen it, right?
Yeah.
You have a cool acronym in your book about resources called SHARP resources.
Yeah.
Which I really like. Can you kind of let everybody know what, because you said, you know, the whole RTVN model, you know, one of the most important parts of that is resources, right? It's like, okay, what do we have? And then you go on to define that further and use this acronym SHARP. Like what does that mean?
Yeah. So, I mean, SHARP itself talks about, you know, the resources being specific, S, hard to copy, rare, and then precious was the final word. I have to be fair here, though, because although the work we did helped develop that, resource theory and strategy has a comparable framework in which it talks about this idea that you can generate competitive advantage based on resources. And this is a long-running framework within the strategic theory field. And I'm sorry to be an academic just for a moment here, but it's important to, you know, recognize when other people have done work. That was pioneered by researchers beginning with Jay Barney. The problem was the acronym they chose was so difficult. The acronym they chose is VRINE, V-R-I-N-E. And then years later, they were able to dramatically improve that by changing it to VRIO, V-R-I-O. And I have tried repeatedly to help people in the entrepreneurial framework to sort of work with that. And for the book, we decided it was time to we just decided, look, this is business models, not strategy. It's fair game to come up with our own acronym that we think is a little bit easier. If nothing else, just for people to remember. The idea behind this is pretty straightforward, right? A resource creates value for a business model based on certain characteristics, right? So if everybody has it, then it's a commodity and it's not really that valuable. And this is where people get tripped up. They're like, oh, well, I have a computer, that's valuable. Well, yeah, it's valuable in the sense that it's worth money, but it's not hard to find, right? It's not, anybody can get one and it's worth a certain amount of money, but you know, you can always raise more money. And so this idea that resources are valuable to a business model when they're very specific. That is, the more specifically they're utilized within the business model as part of the transactions or value creation, the more likely they are to generate a sustainable business model. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if they're hard to copy once they're in place, that means that you'll have less competition. being rare just right off the bat obviously makes something valuable. And then the idea that it's precious, that there's something about it that's helps in generating the value for your customers. This is the V and V-Rine, valuable. You know, that's where we can kind of go through this process of thinking about these things. So I'm doing a business model innovation project right now with a large, with a European multinational, which was actually started before COVID, but started at early stages of COVID, but has taken on new urgency as aspects of their business model just fundamentally don't work. And now they're realizing that those may never return. Literally today they sent me their sharp analysis. So I had asked them to compile a list of resources that they felt fit into this sharp analysis. And it's really hard to do that if you're a big organization, right? Because your instinct is, you know, you just list out all your physical assets, but assets can be tangible or intangible. One of my favorite stories about that is from the people at Lexus. So, and you can find, I don't have the site, the URL on me, but I think we had it in the book, that for a while, Lexus actually, there was one guy, one Japanese man, whose job it was at the end of the production line to run his fingers along all the door edges to make sure that they lined up. And his sense of touch was more accurate than their lasers. Wow. Somehow.
Wow.
And when Toyota brought their first, or I remember if it was Toyota or Lexus, brought their first manufacturing facility to Alabama, they brought him. And it was his job as the cars were first coming off the line, not just to check, but to begin training the other people who were going to take over because he didn't want to live in the US forever. Those kinds of intangible capabilities are what often gets missed, especially at the early stage when you're first starting this business model. Like, what is it that we have that's actually valuable? Sometimes it is just the idea in your head. Sometimes it's your key person's ability to network and understand customers. It might be you have a unique relationship with another organization that, you know, that can be exploited in some way. But going through this process of really thinking about what the key resources are and how the business model will actually use them is incredibly powerful because it'll almost always identify gaps in your resources. What are we missing? Like, what are we going to need in order to be able to actually produce this device or produce this service consistently, right? Not just once, but consistently for each of these customers and ensure that they're getting that value out of it. So the SHARP framework was simply, you know, like so many acronyms in business, it's meant to be a quick shorthand for helping you walk through what are the resources at the organization that are going to really make a difference, whether they're financial, human, physical, knowledge, whether they're tangible or intangible. And so that was the idea behind it. It seems to resonate with people. And I think it's useful in the business model canvas perspective, if nothing else, for just requiring that you sit down and walk through that, because it'll also tell you a little bit about your cost structure.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really good. If it feels like it puts some definition around an otherwise sort of nebulous topic, like, okay, you've got resources and it's like, well, yeah, like, you know, I've got all these different things. What's actually going to be part of the value? One of my early business partners wrote a book called Driven, and he considered something like that to be the genuine asset of the business. Like, what is the genuine asset, you know, behind this business? This is amazing, Dean. You know, I had planned on hogging the mic and selfishly asking Adam all the questions that I want to ask him. But I'm also aware that we're actually getting close to being out of time here. So, my British friend, I feel like I should. And Doug just said we're starting the outro in 1 minute. So, okay. Make it fast.
Well, no, I would just say, no, it's been an awesome show. I think one of the things that we've spoke about here that really resonated with me most is like dealing with the steps of dealing with a new idea when you get that idea. You know, I can definitely look back and say the amount of times when I get an idea and it's like I've just been passed the baton and I run And I'm just running so fast. I'm like, I've got this great thing. So, yeah, I think you've given something for anyone in that situation, which probably all of us at some stage, to really consider and, you know, take positive steps in that direction. So I appreciate sharing that. Helps.
Yeah, that's amazing. So Adam, is, you know, I bought your book off Amazon. If people want to read the book and dig a little bit more into the topic, is that the best place for them to go?
Yeah, it is. And there's the bizmodelbook.com website that has most of the resources. Nice. Including the free work, all the worksheets from the book. They're not even in the book. They're all just online for free that walk you through the process of building a business model. But yeah, if folks are interested, Amazon's is definitely, both in the UK and the US, definitely the easiest place to find it.
That's awesome. So for you guys who are just as interested as I am in this fascinating topic about how to architect, plan, and be very strategic about how you're growing your business, check out Adam's book, The Business Model Book, Design, Build, and Adapt Business Ideas That Drive Business Growth, available on Amazon. Also, bizmodelbook.com.
Yep.
You can find the worksheets and everything, which is very generous for you guys to check things out there. Adam, so thank you so much for being here. I really, really enjoyed the conversation. I hope all of our two listeners enjoyed the conversation just as much as Dean and I did. And for everybody else, make sure that you're tuning in every Tuesday at 1 o'clock Eastern. We are live. Feel free to call in, ask questions, give us a hard time, anything in between, 888-627-6008. And for past episodes and shows, visit us at justtipsshow.com. This is James P. Friel signing off for another episode of Just Tips. Later, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to Just the Tips, where we believe business should be profitable and fun. For show notes, links, and other information on our guests, visit justthetipsshow.com. For more information on how to connect with Dean Holland, visit deanholland.com. And if you'd like to go from being a hustling entrepreneur to an effective CEO capable of running your company without being stuck in the day-to-day, visit me for free training and resources at jamesbfriel.com. Our theme music is Happy Happy Game Show by Kevin MacLeod, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0 license.